This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. We're also brought to you by AudiophileUSA.com, the family-owned and operated used record shop that only sells excellent and near-mint vinyl records. Over 42,000 titles in stock. Search, dig, and load up your cart with your final vinyl upgrades at AudiophileUSA.com. And now, on with the show.
Well, hello there, everyone. Welcome to episode 343 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And today we've got an absolute titan of the keyboard, fellow record collector and mega synth nerd, Mr. Marco Benevento. Now, for those of you who know Marco's music, I can already sense you're getting your cup of tea or flagon of ale ready for the conversation you know is coming. For those of you who aren't familiar with Marco Benevento, I encourage you to check out his work. He's the musician's musician, playing and collaborating with folks like Matt Chamberlain, Trey Anastasio, Joe Russo, John Medeski. Marco is even in Garage à Trois with Mike Dillon and Stanton Moore. So he's made his bones with some of the best. Now today, Marco and I talk records, the story of Fred Short Studios, we nerd out a bit on synthesizers and recording gear, and we talk about the new album, Benevento, available June 10th. There's already a couple of songs available on all streaming services. You can go there now, check them out yourself, and get ready for the full album come June 10th. Plus, of course, there's a vinyl version. Oh, yes, there is vinyl. Go to marcobenevento.com. You can grab a limited pink or classic black vinyl pressing while they last. That's Marco Benevento, the new album, Benevento, available at marcobenevento.com. And hey, if you enjoy Marco Benevento and like this chat, there is an extended version of our conversation available only at patreon.com/vinylguide. That's where I always put extra stuff up there for supporters of the show. Lots more talk, lots more tales, lots more nerding out. Plus, it's all commercial free, and you get to help support the Vinyl Guide podcast. That's a huge help. So please, get up there now. patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support the show and get all the extras. Oh, and one last thing. Make sure to check out some of the Vinyl Guide past episodes featuring interviews with such legends as Kenny Jones of The Who and The Faces, episode 339 of The Vinyl Guide, Ambrose Kenny Smith of King Gizzard, episode 325, Robbie Krieger of The Doors, episode 306, Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, episode 293, Fred Armisen of Saturday Night Live in Portlandia, episode 289, Gary Newman, episode 284, Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick, episode 266, Andy Friggin Partridge of XTC, episode 255, and tons more interviews. Follow The Vinyl Guide for free on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Alrighty, with the upfronts done, let's set our controls for Woodstock, New York, all the way to Fred Short Studios, and have a chat with Mr. Marco Benevento.
Signor Benevento.
Hello, can you... Oh, sorry. Yes, hello.
No worries.
Oh!
Ah, there you are. Man in the shadows.
Wow. I gotta... Let me turn on my lights here.
Oh, far out is... Am I looking at Fred Short Studios there?
Yeah, this is version 2.0 too. I moved to the garage. I moved to this. Our garage is enormous, and it was just like a wood shop and like crap road cases, stuff that we should throw away but never did. And we decided to move my studio, into here. All right, so this is like those are the big brains right there.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, compressors and studio gear that's...
Yeah, old, these are like 40s preamps that Bryce Goggin hit me to, and like the Altec amps are what Leon Michaels hit me to, you know, and all this stuff is just like stuff from studios I just love, the Space Echo, the Tape Echo.
Yeah.
And this is actually a picture of Fred Short himself. There he is.
So... Tell me about Fred Short. That name keeps popping up.
Well, you know, I live on Fred Short Road. So full disclosure, if you want to come visit me, there you go. I live on Fred Short Road and there's only one Fred Short Road in Woodstock. But so this wound up being the street that we live on and that we loved living on. And it was always like whenever you gave anybody your address, it was like, all right, one, you know, I won't say the number, but, you know, Fred Short Road. And they're like, that's an interesting name, like a guy's name, like Fred Short. And they're like, oh, and any just random, like paying a credit card bill, like paying what, you know, whatever, going online and just telling people where you live. And then I just decided I would make up a story about Fred Short and like make a record called The Story of Fred Short and just make up this. I just I'm going to make like a concept record about Fred Short, this guy that I don't even know about, but I'm going to just pretend. Make a story up. And I like basically was saying, made up a story about how he was like a Native American who used to like live here and have like ayahuasca ceremonies around the fire. And he also like was a musician and would have people come play. And it was like a really like, this was like a sort of sacred land, like back in the early, you know, 1800s. And I like made up this whole story about it. And I made a record called The Story of Fred Short and like sang about like the lyrics are really sort of vague and whatever, but it's like sort of a made up story about Fred Short. And so then I would tour, when we were touring the record, I would, you know, do radio interviews and just say this stuff, you know, like full on, like just story,
create
right?
The
know,
legend. Like made up.
Create the legend. Right? So then I did an interview in Woodstock, which is where I live. And I got home, like I went to WDST Radio Woodstock, did the interview, came home, and then within like 10 minutes, I got an email from like Joanne Short. And she was like, I just heard your interview on WDST. And in fact, Fred Short was not a piano player, or musician, and he didn't host ayahuasca ceremonies. He was my great grandfather. He was just a blue stone layer and had a farm. And he wasn't musical. Actually, the only musical person in the family is me, you know, and all this stuff. And I got a little nervous for a second. And then I was like, oh, wait, she's just kind of reaching out just to like let me know. And I emailed her back and said, oh, yeah, like I'm just a musician making up a crazy story. Like, also, holy shit, right. Like, nice to meet you. I always wondered who the heck Fred Short was anyway. And he's like, she was like, oh, yeah. And she was really nice. And she's like, oh, yeah, he's my great grandfather. And then, you know, told me, you know, he was just kind of a normal guy, like raised cattle and, you know, whatever. It was a blue stone there and whatever. And then I went to recently, this was like 8 years ago. It was kind of a long time ago. And so then I actually went to Kingston, which is near here, to pay this like alarm bill that we have, our alarm company. And she was there and she was like, oh yeah, I'm Joanne Short. I'm the one that you talked to on the, I'm the one that emailed you. And she's like, since then I've checked out your music and I'm a huge fan and I really like your music. And is there any way I can get a record or a t-shirt or whatever? And I was like, yes, I just sent it. And I sent her like a care package of things.
So I have it on good word that you're a bit of a record nerd, aside from a gear nerd. Would that be right?
I wanted to say I do like seeing your record shelf.
Oh, yes. I'm
right there. I should really take you inside and show you the records I got in there. But I also in the studio have a couple, you know, turntables and cassette deck, and I just have a small collection of records over here. But in the house is like, you know,
is it a problem?
It's a problem. Yeah. It's a problem, but you know, like, I gotta say, it's not, you know, when you find something that really inspires you and like, and really like moves you, and you're like, I need this, like, I wanna learn about this. This is like an endless, it's like learning music in general, like harmony and rhythm and everything. You're like, oh, I just wanna know everything about that. And John Coltrane spent his whole life, not, you know, and still unsatisfied, you know what I mean? Like it's always a search with music, even in that regard. And I feel like records, and learning about bands and engineers and studios and you know, like the Wrecking Crew, like a amazing group of people, you know, in all these different parts of the country around the studios. And you're like, I want to know all about that, you know, like, and that's what, and that's for me, that's the vinyl obsession. But it's like, it's good for, it's great for me. That's what musicians should be doing, like checking out what's been made before, you know, and like, hearing the stuff that's already been made, and you're like, you think you're doing something new, and you're like, dude, that was made like 30 years ago.
What's your kind of rhythm with looking for records? Are you always kind of crate digging, always kind of?
Oh, absolutely. Every time I go to a city, I go to the record store. Like going around all the different towns, I definitely always go to record stores and crate dig for sure. But also, like, if I'm like hanging out with my buddy who I admire and look up to and love and musically connect with, and we're talking about records, and he's like, tells me about this Beach Boys record that I've never heard of, and he's just like, well, you have to have that record. And then I sort of just like, I'm on the phone instantly on eBay, just like, I'm just gonna buy this now because I'm not gonna remember tomorrow morning what record he's talking about. And if I take a screenshot, like, I might, like, so sometimes I do the instant, like, on the phone, eBay buy, while talking to my buddy, like, I just bought that Quincy Jones record. I can't believe I don't have it. You know, I just bought it. He's like, really? I'm like, well, yeah. And, you know, you can kind of just do it real quick and finally, like, $25, seller from Ohio, perfect. You know, like, near you or whatever. Right. Anyway.
Are you very precious about it being a first pressing, or any sort of collector penchant you have around?
Not really, no. But I do. I do understand that and know that I'm not quite that deep with it. I've hung with some serious vinyl dudes, you know, Ethan from Now and Again Records. Now Again Records.
Yeah,
he's like a crazy vinyl junkie, and he's all about that. And Leon Michaels, this producer I've worked with a bunch, and a friend of mine who lives upstate here, goes by L. Michaels Affair. Anyway, he also has like a thing like that too, where like he DJs and I'll DJ with him, and he'll just be like, what is that, second pressing? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, oh, yeah. You know, just like,
that's cute.
Like, I don't, you know, and that was kind of expensive. Like, it was like $40, 45, you know, which is expensive for 45. And obviously there's lots of other ranges of pricings for 45.
What's the most you've ever spent on a record?
Probably on a James Booker record, over $100 on a James Booker record. Mm-hmm. Just because I'm obsessed with him, and I'm a piano player. He's like a piano player, and I look up to him so much. And I've been sort of hired to play his music for like my friends. And then it wound up being a thing, and I've done it in New Orleans a bunch. And I like really dove in to the Booker thing. And I was like, you know what? Like, I want his records. Like, I want all of his records. Mm-hmm. You know, I play like him, or I try to play like him, or, you know, and I love his playing. And my go-to is sort of that sound,
right?
In a way, which is kind of crazy because I'm from New Jersey, but I just love New Orleans. I've been going there every year for the last like 15 or 20 years of my life. And I look up to Booker so much, and I even have a picture of him on my wall right here. But
right so, next to Fred, yeah, Short.
It was a Booker, exactly. Right, exactly. So, yeah. What about you? I know that's kind of a personal question, but I know that there's, you know, I know the value of records and the.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I've gone over $1,000 for a couple of records. One of them was a Butcher cover, because I didn't have a Butcher cover, and I was like, you know what, if anything, I need, you know, as a record collector, I should have one at least for a while. And it's one of those things to where it'll pass through my hands, and I know it'll probably wind up somewhere else. It's funny, because I bought the Butcher cover, and I was like, I finally got it. I had this windfall of money, and the record dealer friend of mine had the Butcher cover, and I called him up, and I think he had some, you know, $2,000 price on it. I said, what do you really need for that? And he says, the longer you talk about it, the more the price goes up. So I immediately hung up.
Holy shit. No, really?
Yeah.
Dude, This is a great story. I love this.
So he called me back, and we worked out a deal, and I got it. And I don't know if you know much about the Beatles pressings between the UK and the US.
I mean, I know a little bit about it, but yes. Yeah.
The UK pressings, I've got UK pressings, and they sound phenomenal. US pressings were from second and third generation tapes, and so they sound, you know, not as good. You put them next to each other, you could definitely hear the difference. But, you know, the American kids in the 60s, they had nothing to compare it to. So, yeah, it just sounded like the Beatles to them. They focused on the music where, you know, unfortunately, I've got something to compare it to, and I could kind of hear the quality difference. So it's the most expensive record I ever bought, and it's also the worst sounding Beatles record I have.
You know what's also great, like on the flip side, like just going to a record store and finding those records that are always going to be like $1 or $5.
Mm-hmm.
But are like always awesome. And yeah. I always get like, you know, like McCartney, like the first McCartney record or mm-hmm. something. Like,
yeah.
You can kind of find that everywhere. Even like a Herb Alpert record, you know, like there's all these like just great records out there that are always going to be super cheap. And, you know, and I always wind up buying, like, I think I have like 4 copies of that McCartney record just to like make sure I have it. Like, I just gave it to a friend who doesn't have it, you know.
Yeah,
like,
you can't pass it up, especially if it's a couple bucks.
Yeah, exactly.
We had John Dwyer, OCs, on the show not long ago, and he and I were talking about, you know, this sort of thing, this concept of you can't pass up certain records. And mine is, one of mine is Miles Davis, Tribute to Jack Johnson. If I see a copy of that, I have to get it. And then I start, $5, $10, and I'll start handing it out like a freaking doctor with a prescription. Like, you know, you don't have this here. You need to take this with 2 bottles of wine. You know.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. I'm of the same nature too. Just like, you know, friend, or even like All Things Must Pass. I had like 3 copies of that or more, you know, and it was my buddy's birthday, and I was like, and I was out of town, and my wife was like, what do I get him? I was like, just give him a copy of All Things Must Pass. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
Great, you know, it's like, I don't know. Yeah. There's like, it's funny how records are. They're like cheap, or they're like a crazy, you know, valuable, or anyway.
Yeah. Well, same like music gear. I would imagine you've got quite a bit of gear there, and hope, I assume you also amassed it maybe earlier in the career. Yeah. Some of the Moogs at this point are pretty untouchable.
We'll be back after these messages.
Well, hey everyone, I'm here to tell you about AudiophileUSA.com. Used records online that require no guesswork are all in excellent and near mint condition, many of them still sealed. Get your final vinyl upgrades at AudiophileUSA.com. Only the best and cleanest vinyl records. Here, do this now. Jump on their website, AudiophileUSA.com. Quickly search their incredible inventory of over 42,000 vinyl titles by artist, genre, even by record label, and fill up your cart with some glorious used records. Enhance your record collection with the best used records around. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
Well, same like music gear. I would imagine you've got quite a bit of gear there. And hope, I assume you also amassed it maybe earlier in the career. Yeah. Some of the Moogs at this point are pretty untouchable. You know?
Dude, I know. You know, it's crazy. So I... Check this out. So I did a gig with Bernie Worrell like 10 years ago or so. And he in his rig, he had like a clavinet, you know, obviously an amazing, vintage, awesome, legendary keyboard. Everyone knows the value of a clavinet. He had a Mini Moog. He had a Rhodes. He had, you know, a Hammond, like all the classic vintage gear. And then he had like this thing. This is a Kauai.
Yeah.
A Kauai. I mean, look at it. It looks like it's like from a thrift store, yeah. Right? A Kauai PH50, right? And I was like, dude, I got to ask you, like, you have all these amazing keyboards. What the hell is up with this Kauai? And he's like, when's your birthday? Because he's a numerologist. I don't know if you know.
Okay. But,
and he's like, well, when's your birthday? And I was like, okay, July 22nd. He's like, George Clinton. He's like, I knew it. You had this George Clinton vibe. I was like, what? He's like, George, you and George have the same birthday. And I was like, holy shit, that's amazing. And I was like, well, dude, like, what's up with this keyboard? Why do you have it? He's like, well, George bought everybody in P-Funk this Kauai keyboard back in like the 80s because he swore it sounded exactly like the ARP string ensemble. Like mm-hmm. his patch on it is like, you know. So I like, he's like, you can get one on eBay for like $40, you know. Mm-hmm. And I like,
shipping's more than the keyboard.
All right. Immediately went online and like found one and bought it and was like, sweet, I got the keyboard, right? So this is like 10 years ago or whatever. So I've been recording in here for a while, and with Leon, again, amazing musician, great friend, producer, and we've been using that thing a lot. And I was like, dude, and I told him that whole story I just told you, and he went on eBay to try to buy one, and they're like $500 or something. Oh. You know, and I was like, oh, somebody that, you know, like that's what happened.
Out.
The secret's out. Like, that's why there's like all of a sudden a, you know, like there was probably a time when you could buy a Mellotron for like $500 and then, you know, or like get one for free because like Rick Wakeman was like burning them in bonfires because he was freaking so frustrated with how shitty they are. And, but, you know, and then like meanwhile, the price goes up. For some reason, you know, I don't know. Anyway, it's so weird how that works, mm-hmm. you know. Wurlitzer electric pianos are so expensive because of people realizing their worth, and even like Hammond organs. And but yeah, that's how it is with records as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, but with yeah. like you play a B3, is that right?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the synthesizer that comes closest to the B3? Like if you were in a squeeze and you couldn't get the B3 on tour to a show, what would you bring?
You know, there's a large gap between the real and the fake.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll start by saying that. But of course, I have dealt with using something else. There's like a computer software, which is crazy to say, but there's a computer software called B4, okay. Like, you know, B3 and then B4. And I ran that through a MIDI keyboard and through a Leslie, like through a real Leslie. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this sounds really freaking good. And I even did like a tour with one of them. And I was like, this is kind of amazing. I mean, it's definitely lacking something, but like that kind of works. But it's hard to find. It's hard to find a B3 replica that really works. But, you know, there's that Yamaha. Have you ever heard of this? Is actually pretty cool. Yamaha made a series called the Reface series.
Reface. Okay.
Yeah, and they did like they made these little miniature replicas of like they made like a oh yeah. So I have this thing. It's like $400. Oh right. Okay. So I use this through an amp. This like red keyboard.
Okay, yeah. It's $400 and it has something like that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it has mini keys. I would say this is amazing. The Yamaha Reface YC is actually, and you wouldn't think because it's like tiny keys and everything, but the controls are really good on it. And if you run that through a tube amp, it's really good. Actually, I used it on a gig in like Central Park with like Warren Haynes and like an orchestra for some Grateful Dead thing. I think Eric Krasno was playing guitar on some stuff. And he was like, can you come down to the city for a gig? And I'm like, all right, yeah. And I'm like, what about backline? He's like, well, there's no backline, and I need like piano and organ. And I was like, so you want me to drive from Woodstock to New York and bring my own piano and organ? So, and I, for most keyboardists, they'd be like, oh yeah, sure, I have a digital. Like, I don't have like a lot of digital, smaller rigs. You know, I have like the real thing, right. Or like so. But I found I had this thing, and I brought it, and I put it on like an 88 key keyboard that I kind of liked. Piano sound, actually Casio, that worked great. and I just put that right on top of it and ran it through like a Sears Silvertone, like an old amp. And after the gig, he was like, "Man, what's that organ sound you had? That was really good." I actually thought he was maybe coming over to be like, "What's that organ sound?" You know, like, but because I was playing, I'm like, "This kind of sounds amazing." It has like the Leslie switch on it, and even has built-in speakers, so it's like vibrating when you're playing it a little bit. And you know, it has the draw bars, it has built-in reverb and distortion. There's a lot of like just familiar knobs that you're like, "Yes, I need these knobs right now." You know, and it even has like a input for a volume pedal,
swell pedal,
swell pedal. So you get that as well. So yeah, that I would say. The Yamaha and B4 have been my sort of go-to achies. I definitely do not like the Nord. Something about the Nord, just I don't like the sound. There's like definitely a go-to shitty substitutes that are at like all these festivals that are at like Backline gear, you know, right. Backline. And you're just like, "No, dude, I don't want that at all. It sounds horrible. I'd rather have like this tiny little keyboard or something."
Yeah. I think it's interesting how now a lot of those patents are expiring for the synthesizers that were in the 70s and 80s, and which puts them in public domain. And so now anyone can kind of start to, there's companies out there that make exact replicas of the Prophet 5s and things based on the original circuitry, but they don't have the shortcomings of like the power supply issues and things like that. So, you know, those replicas can be cheap, and that's the only way I'll be able to afford one now.
Yeah, I actually bought one of those, like a super cheap piece of shit Behringer that's like supposed to replicate the Model D, the Moog Model D. And I bought it because I was like, I want one for the road. Like, I want something that does what the Model D does, but on the road. And I don't want to take a $6,000.
Yeah, that's cheap. So that's you don't cheap care version. So much about, right?
You know what I mean? Like, that goes in the trailer at the hotel, the sketchy hotel I'm staying at, that our trailer might get stolen. You know, it's like, I don't want that, like, on the road. Like, I want something that, like, is kind of a shittier version of that for the road, but, like, does the shit kind of what I'm used to, you know? And, but yeah, I know a friend of mine saw a post of like a photo of my keyboard rig, and it was like, you know, like digital piano and like all the sort of tiny, like the replicas, like the cheaper replicas. And he was like, "Boo, Behringer." And I was like, "Dude, you should hear it through a PV amp. It sounds awesome." So we're like, you know, like, I mean, I know the importance of really good gear and of things, and I know, and I've done it the other way, where I take my most favorite piece of gear on the road, and I take it home, and I'm like, "Why did I just do that? Like, it's like trash, you know?"
Yeah,
it's, like, it's, you know, somebody spilled a beer on it, and you know, it's like, it could happen here in the studio, but less likely that it would happen here in your own studio where it's
there's a psychic cost. Of you always kind of having part of your brain like, "I'm a little worried about that. I'm a little concerned about that." Yeah.
Totally. And then you become like that musician on the road that's like, "Dude, my gear." And I'm like, I don't want to be like, it's like, no, there's no time for that on the road. I can't even get myself awake in the morning and on the plane, let alone like worry about like a piece of synthesizer that won't work, you know, like anyway. So I've, you know, whatever you make lemonade, you know, I mean, you do the best you can, and like, you know, and I maybe, you know, and then if it was like super rock stardom where you have trucks and roadies and people handling your shit, you know, and you have insurance and you have, you know, like that's a thing, but like, it's, you know, I don't, tour bus doesn't pull up to my house and pick me up every time I go on tour yet. But you know, so right now I just want something that does the job. So.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, look, I can't help but sidetrack into synthesizers. I used to be a synthesist. I used to actually program for some of the companies back in my youth. Really? Yeah. Yeah. I do the presets for InSonic, Korg. I worked for Emu for a while. It's all freelance. They would send me the prototypes, and then I would program, you know, I'd figure out kind of what the synthesis kind of model is, you know, how many LFOs, how many envelopes, and what the sample base or the wave base, you know, starts out with. And then I'd add, you know, let's find a trumpet. Okay, let's get the right vibrato for a trumpet for the controllers. And so I'd send in probably 100 different patches. And then they would just send me a brand new, they would put some of mine together with someone else's. There'd probably 6 or 7 of us doing it. And then that would be the presets for the keyboard when it shipped.
So, dude, that's amazing. I wish Kevin just told me that. Like, dude, you got an interview with this guy. And I was like, he said all of that, I would have been like, that's all, yeah, let's talk. No, that's amazing. That is so cool, dude. I love that I know that about you and that you did that. That's so awesome. That is amazing.
Oh.
Because I was the 12-year-old that bought that keyboard and, you know, hit trumpet sound and hit the sound. And I was like, and you were the one that made it. And because it was all like that. I remember even getting, I had a subscription to Keyboard Magazine and like getting like, you know, any like free VHS tape I could get. And one was from Ensoniq.
Yeah.
And I remember like the guy, I probably have this VHS somewhere still, but I remember the guy like explaining the parameters of everything. And I just was like glued to the TV, like, what is this? Like, this is so cool. And I remember, this is really funny because the guy was talking about, oh yes, there's a sequencer and you could record. And then you can quantize. And I was like, what the fuck is quantize? And then I like rewound it and heard him say that. And I was like, Dad, I was like, what is, and my uncle wasn't, I'm like, what does he say? And they both didn't know. They're like, I don't even know what quantize is. And I remember like hearing about that on an Ensoniq video and just like in like the early 90s. And anyway, my point is I know those factory sounds. I know those synthesizers in that time period.
Yeah. When I think about it, I just know like, oh God, the Ensoniqs just kept breaking down. The Kurzweils, they would always change the operating system, which would wipe out my sounds. Like I know the flaws. I know the things that really sucked about it. That's because I had to live that for a while.
That's so interesting. That's so funny.
So you are pretty much I'll call it an analog purist from an instrumentalization point of view. Do you also record onto analog tape or are you Pro Tools at that point?
I can do either. I do love working on this guy right here, the Tascam 388.
I had one of those.
Yeah.
I love those things.
These are great. And they're speaking of what we were talking about, how instruments and gear going up in value. Those definitely have. I bought this for $250 like 15 years ago. Now they're like $4,000, you know, they're crazy.
They're so
crazy.
Great.
They're so great. And then I also have this guy, the 2-track that I use frequently, Otari 2-track. And sometimes if I'm in here, like recording a couple people, we'll go straight to tape, which is really fun. I really like the element of tape because you can be like, we played that too slow. And then you like, just like speed up the tape a little and you're like, perfect.
Yeah.
And it also does something to the sound and like it kind of, or you could purposely record something fast and slow it down, like record a couple steps up and slow it down. And you're like, yeah, that's cool. It makes the snare drum sound really weird. So anyway, I do like doing that. I mean, generally I record on the Pro Tools just cause it's quicker, faster than I could dump it onto the tape afterwards. And then dump it back in the computer. So I'm not really a purist in that way. I definitely go 50-50 on it, but I always find that I have more fun committing to tape.
Yeah. So the new album Benevento, was that recorded onto 388 or was that Pro Tools or a mixture of all?
It was a mixture of all. It was definitely a mixture of all. It hit multiple tape machines before it hit anyone's ears. Mm-hmm. Like almost to the point where like sometimes I hear it and I'm like, this is so fucked up. Like, this sounds like so shitty. Like if you, and I think the guys that were mixing and mastering it were kind of like, yo, this is pretty gnarly. But I did like the way it came out. And you know, upon listening to it now, when I hear it, I don't hear how gnarly it is quite, you know what I mean? Like, but when you're in the microscopic moment of it all, like I might be like, oh my God, like, is this passable? Is this okay? But,
It's part of the quality of it. I was listening to it, and I could hear the tape hiss, and it sounds to be. And I spent a large part of my life in front of a 388 and different tape machines. Like I maybe that's why it was more endearing for me. Maybe some people may call it lo-fi, but you know, at that point, once you get used to it, in the first 6 seconds of a song, you're like, oh, here's where we're at. You acclimate your ears, and then you focus on the actual music.
Yeah, I love hearing other records like Roberta Flack records and Beatles records or whatever. Every older record, Roy Ayers, Quincy Jones, I don't know, anything. I'm just rattling off random people that I like. But you put on a record, or you put on whatever, even if you press play on Spotify, you hear that it's like, shh, and then the song starts.
Yeah.
And even you hear the compression of the tape as... which is amazing. I love that. And I really I hear a lot of that in the record I just made, like sort of after the fact, where I'm like, wow, you could really hear how the tape was really messing with the drums and the keyboards and the compressor really, I don't know. I don't even know how to describe it, but I really liked the way I used sort of tape and air and just that element in the record, because it's like part of the song, you know. It's like, which is kind of crazy, but I bounced it to this 388 and then I bounced it to this two track, and then I have a small four track tape recorder with a cassette, and I bounced everything to four track. Every song got bounced to four tracks on the four track recorder, and then I sent those four tracks to the guy to mix.
Right.
So it was like drums, bass, vocals, and then like overdubs, which was like a million things into one track, you know, like basically like keyboards and like whatever, all sorts of other stuff.
So when you're working with a song and you're at that point to where you've got all the basic tracks, you've got the vocals on it, and you're bouncing tracks back and forth, you have to learn at some point that it's done. Even though you could probably keep fiddling with it, maybe there's that urge to, okay, what else is it needing? Maybe over-analyzing kind of where you're at in the song. How do you know when to stop?
That's a good question, and I feel like that's a great question for every musician. And every musician would have a different answer and also would admit to struggling with that, because it's easy to work on an album for 2 years. Mm-hmm. It's easy to work on an album for 3 years. It's easy to work on an album for 4 years. It's easy to dwell on what you're working on for a long period of time. And it's hard to know when it's over. You could re-record it. You could re-record it again. You know, you could. And I've dealt with that. And a lot of these songs, I kind of have dealt with that before. And even past songs, I've dealt with is that tempo fast enough? Let's re-record it. I think it should be faster. Then you re-record it. And you try it live and you're like, no, man, that other tempo was better. We got to get back. It doesn't feel slow. That felt too fast. And you go back, you know, so there's a lot of that going on. I guess like my advice to myself and even to other musicians is like, you know, put a deadline on it.
Right.
You know, just be like, dude, I need the masters by August 15th. You know, I need the guy to, you know. And then you're like, you know, you have to at least have a period of time where you could be like, okay, I'm definitely gonna finish this. This is pretty much done. I need to just finish this, and I don't know why I'm dwelling upon it, but it needs to be done. Because otherwise, it's like, you know, if you're cooking and you like keep on messing with the food as you're cooking it, then it just becomes this like slop. Like sometimes you just
need to mush.
Yeah. Sometimes you just need to like cook it, leave it. It's like a steak, you know, right? You just cook it, you burn it, you cook it, and then you put it in the oven, then you just take it out, you cut it, boom, it's good. Like you don't mess with it, you don't poke it too much, you know. Mm-hmm. Like all vegetables and rice, if you keep on sticking at it, it's just gonna become, right, it's like you said, like a gray mush. So it's, I feel like music is the same thing, where like if you keep on messing with it, it's just, you're gonna forget what you were even thinking about when you wrote it, or when you just thought the melody was conceived or whatever. And
I guess that was easy prior to COVID. I mean, you were doing an album a year, you know, 2014, 15, 16, 17. And then all of a sudden COVID hits and you have really nothing else to do but dwell in the studio. Did that become a problem?
In a way, yes. But also in a way, no, because I had never spent that much time in my studio without any interruption, without any having to fly somewhere, without any having to go away for 2 weeks or without anything. I was just home. The kids were home. My wife was home. We all like ate together, hung out, went on walks together, just like kept everybody in check. And then it was like kids watch movies, do artwork, do whatever, play ping pong. Mom makes jewelry. Dad goes in the studio. And that like that happened for, like you said, like 2 years. So I was really enjoying it. I loved it. and some of my musician friends had a more of a miserable time with it because they were in the cities. They lost their studio. They couldn't play their instrument for months at a time. And I was like, whoa, I forgot about the flip side of the coin. You know, like I'm like living up here in the woods, like perfectly isolated. This is great. You know, so I in a way, it was awesome. I could just work on my shit all the time, but I didn't have a reference period. The thing about going on tour and the thing about doing other things is that you get your head out of where you're at, you know? I didn't have a chance to fully lift myself out of what I was working on. And when I listened to even this record and what will be eventually a sequel to this record soon, because I have so much music because I was very productive during the pandemic. To me, it sounds like a guy slightly isolated in the woods that like spent too much time on this record, you know, like, like it sounds like kind of almost like just like, what is going on? It's like musical input overload, of like synthesizers and, you know, drum machines and tape machines. And so it was like, it was a great thing. And it was also like a, whoa, like, I can't believe I made this. Like the canvas is covered in layers and layers of paint. But you know, I could have not put it out and that would have been fine too. But I thought I should put this thing out, you know, like I should let people hear this. Like,
so there was doubt. There was doubt whether
there was doubt. There was doubt. I definitely was like, this is insane. There's no like if I put this out, like I should tell people it's like my experimental record, or like it's like a different record than other ones. I feel like in my own mind, maybe it's the same shit for people. Maybe they're like, oh yeah, it sounds like a Marco record, but in my mind, it sounds different to me, you know. But yeah, that was what the pandemic was anyway. So I was like, let's do it, you know. Snapshot in time, let's put it out. And I'm even following through on like the sequel pretty quickly, because I have a lot of shit that I have made during the pandemic. But
yeah,
it's kind of both. It's both things of like, it's really interesting and really weird, but it's also like, wow, like that was, that guy was really trapped up there for a while.
Well, maybe oddly enough, I mean, I think a lot of people can kind of relate to it. So maybe in a different way, your album is kind of okay. Well, that's everyone else kind of went through that mood. That zeitgeist is there.
Yes. You know?
So yeah.
No, it definitely. Yeah. And there was definitely doubt. Like I was like, I don't even know. Like, I don't even know where to begin with this. I don't even know if it's a record. I mean, I'm looking at like 30 songs where it's like some shit's like sort of depressing sounding, you know, and then some's like just like weird like piano solo thing over a drum machine with like, and then like one, you know, and then I don't know, like doesn't, and then going back to McCartney, like his first record or something, like, and then I was like, you know, like that, like there's like so many little blips of like weird, like Lovely Linda is like 20 seconds long, or I don't know. Like, what is that first song? Like, you know, it's like, even that whole record, it sounds like he didn't give a fuck, kind of like, you know, he had some songs, and then there was also these weird little experimentations. And I always, in the back of my mind, always wanted to have a record that was like, where's the record with like the weird Marco, you know, like there's weird stuff out there, but it's maybe more piano-y, more jazzy or something, but this record and the songs on this record is different. It's like, it's like Moog filters and, you know, just like different sounds that I feel like I'm. So, and also the biggest thing is the fact that I'm playing drums and bass. I never made a record where I'm playing all the instruments. And I remember telling a friend of mine that, and he was like, wait, you never did that? And I thought, like, I was like, oh, that's cool. You think that. And no, I haven't done it, but I'm doing it now. And I kind of just committed to it. I was like, yeah, I'm going to do a record where I'm doing everything. And I'm not very good at the drums at all.
Now, how involved are you with your videos? Because watching your videos are very creative, and I can tell a lot of effort goes into it. I'm curious as to your role within creating those videos, or do you hand them off and the video artist just kind of runs with it?
I've made them all myself, and I'm proud to say that I have. I have a VHS recorder. I know Final Cut. I know GoPro cameras. I know how to do all that shit. And wow. I made them all myself. I mean, in this day, like, even my managers, it's kind of like, I don't know, could you just do it yourself? Like, I mean, like, it's just like, it's almost expected. Like, bands are like making their own videos themselves, or they're hiring people to do it for themselves and it's costing them thousands of dollars. And granted, we've made a couple of those, but not many. The majority of the latest videos I've done myself, you know, and it's a lot more work, and you have to, yeah, it's a lot more work, a lot more time, and it's a little bit frustrating because it's like overload. You want to be working on music and editing your own stuff, but now you're like learning shortcuts for Final Cut Pro, and you're like,
is this the best use of my time?
You know, and you're like, and your hard drive is filling, you know, like, oh, what am I doing? But ultimately, it's just like when you do the shit yourself, it's going to be exactly what you want it to look like versus hiring someone to do it. You know, it's like just kind of taking the extra effort, not just the extra effort, but like kind of just like kind of going for it and being like, just try to do it. And I'm glad I did do it too. I mean, it was like, you know, yeah, it was a lot of work and a lot of time, and you know, but in the end, you get what you want to get. And like, I was even inspired to do it. I was even talking to Leon Michaels about it. He kind of was like, why don't you just get the VHS camera on eBay and just try to do it yourself? And I was like, right, why don't I just see if I can find one and just get that grainy look like myself and get like a US, like, because there's converters, you can, if you want to do it, you could figure it out. Mm-hmm. It really is, it's basically that. And I was like, you know what, the whole process of making Let It Slide, the record before this, was like very just like, yeah, we're all doing it ourselves, like hands-on. I was like, I'm gonna just make these videos myself. So all those Let It Slide, you could say it's all the same, and Nature's Change, those three videos I made myself and edited them.
Wow.
Even like put a camera and like moved my head and like recorded it and like went back to look at it. I was like, oh my God, that's so off. And then like focused it and then like did it again. And then like watched it, you know, it was like stupid shit, you know, but.
Because there's a lot of commonalities between audio editing and video editing, you know, the butt splices, the transitions, those sort of, you know, the same conceptual areas. But then you have to worry about things like lighting and stuff that like, you know, oh, this is a whole art in itself. And I'm sitting here with a ring light that I bought from Walgreens for $10. You know, it's like, is this really kind of, am I going beyond my boundaries here? Do you start to get tired of your own music when you're so far into working on a project like a video?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm like, no one's going to like the song anyway. Why am I even making this video? You know?
Yeah.
But then, you know, of course you just take time away from it. Like now when I look at the videos that I made 3 or 4 years ago, I'm like, oh wow, I'm glad I did that. Because when you watch it, you're like, oh, it's 2.5 minutes, 3.5 minutes, right? It's not like that long, but like editing it takes you like a month and a half, you know, and like filming it and then all that stuff is just time consuming. And not to mention, like, I kind of don't want to do it also. So I'm like sitting there like, oh, you know, like I'm not the fastest at it, you know, versus Pro Tools. I'm a lot quicker with like cutting and splicing and making things happen. But you know, anyway. And then you like learned about, and my friend was like, why are you editing in Final Cut? You should be using Premiere. And I'm like, I'm going to learn a new program right now. Which I should. I feel like a lot of people have said that to me. So, but I mean, I don't know. I've always been like a little bit of a nerdy, you know, computery, figure it out kind of guy. You know, like I use Photoshop a lot and do a lot of things like that. Album art. I did the album art for Let It Slide even. And like, you know, like I'm into that stuff. I mean, once you start learning about it, like you said, a lot of the key bands are similar, and it's, you might as well just kind of try to do it yourself kind of thing. Before you hire somebody, explain it to them, pay them a bunch of dough, and then
go forth
and then get something you kind of don't like, you know, or something, which happens, but, and also the opposite happens too, where you get something amazing. But,
You did the cover for Let It Slide. So the ring of the record around.
I'll tell
the
you
cover
what that is. That's the White Album. I scanned in the White Album and the one that I have, my copy, so it's worn in. I scanned that in and used that and, like, you know, got rid of the the font. And I did what's it called? Oh, I forget. You know, like back in the, I guess it maybe was like 70s or 80s, there was like the letters that you could like, Letraset. Remember Letraset? It was like a transparency with like 5 A's, 5 B's.
Oh yeah, so you could make flyers and stuff like
that.
Yeah,
and then you like etch the letter in, and it like you pull it off and it's on the paper.
Yeah.
So the title is from Letraset, like Let It Slide, and my name is, I did it on Letraset and scanned it in on the printer and then put it in Photoshop. And for this record, for the newest record, it was like I fully put it in the hands of Danny, who works for High Tide. And they make incredible album art. They've done stuff with Big Crown and all sorts of people. And I was kind of like really impressed with all their stuff. And I was getting to know all those guys. And I was like, dude, I want you to do it. And he just came out with like 5 different layouts. They were all great. And it was nice to work with someone whose job that is. You know what I mean? Like it's not, as a musician, like, I like doing it all, but I also like just like learning about the music and being like, yo, you're a professional art guy. You should do it. Don't let me do it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I could hack something together, but then when I work with someone who really knows what they're doing, it's like, oh, here's the image and here's a color palette that would complement for different things. I'm like, you know, I didn't even think about that. There's no way I could have really even imagined, you know.
Right.
So do you do much other stuff with, I know you're co-founder Royal Potato Family, besides making music, what other involvement do you have in the label? What's your role there?
Oh, you know, that's honestly very hands off. Kevin, that's all Kevin. It was my idea to start, and then it became, you know, it became our thing, Kevin's thing, and we started getting our friends on the label. And then it was one of those things where, like, why, you know, I'm like, Kevin's got this. Kevin's the dude that wanted the record label and wanted to run it, and I was the guy that wanted to start it.
Oh, he loves it. Yeah, you can tell.
And I love it too, because it's all my friends, and all my friends know that Kevin's very fair and is a nice guy, and he's not in it for, he's not a crook. You know, he's just like, he loves music. He goes to Jazz Fest every year. He goes to every festival he could go to. You know, like, he loves live music, and he loves all, you know, all the friends, all my friends that are on the label. He'll even put some people on the label that I've never heard of, and I'll be like, "Whoa, never checked this person out. This one." I'm not involved in that, and I don't think he wants me to be involved in it. I think Kevin, at this point, wants me to just like make records and like just worry about making videos and records and album art. You know.
All right, Marco, thank you so much for joining us here. I want to remind folks the new album Benevento is going to be available June 10th. Right now, you can go up to your streaming services and download a song or two. There's some videos, at least one video as well for the new album, I believe. Maybe two. Depends how how much time Marco gets to work on them. But go to your Apple Music, your Spotify, whatever streaming you have. Set yourself up to get the full album on June 10th on your streaming services. And, of course, you could order the vinyl right now, MarcoBenevento.com. There is a limited edition pink version out there, which I recommend you grab while it's still there, as well as standard black. And, of course, his whole back catalog can be had at Royal Potato Family Music. Marco, thank you so much for coming on the show. You're welcome back to Nerd Out anytime, man.
Dude, man, thanks for having me. Really great to meet you and chat with you.
Oh, there he is. What a lovely guy, Mr. Marco Benevento. Always welcome back on the show. Love nerding out with folks like that. Multiple layers. There's vinyl, there's synths, there's recording gear. And don't forget, there's an extended version of this interview at patreon.com/vinylguide. Please head up there now. Help support this show. Get all the extras. That's always a huge help. patreon.com/vinylguide. That's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter. Spread the word of The Vinyl Guide podcast. That's a huge help. And of course, for your friends who aren't quite as tech savvy as you may be, always grab their smartphone and show them how they can get The Vinyl Guide podcast on their podcast app. That's a huge help. They'll thank you for it. Certainly, I'll appreciate it as well. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.